Hey there, it's Mike Tramp, and you're listening to White Line Fever, where rock and roll is still alive like it always has been and it always will be.
Welcome to a new episode. My name's Dean Mascor. This is White Line Fever, and our guest who's been on two previous shows is Luke Morley. I'm confusing the hell out of him with all this, but Luke, I'll be more less esoteric this time. So can you tell us a little bit about the union? What happened to the band, the union? Is a possibility of you guys working together again? What's the story there?
Well, probably not, because Thunder is like a monster. It's so time consuming. It's a big beast that takes over all their lives. So chances are probably a little bit slim. Sorry about that, but I've got another interview. It was supposed to have started 2 minutes ago.
Okay, cool. Very quickly, why don't you tell us about your first trip to Vegas and then we'll play that song and then we'll be done.
It wasn't actually Vegas, it was L.A.
L.A., okay. Tell us about the Sin City. First trip.
Yeah, myself and Danny went over to America in 1988 on a kind of fact-finding mission because, you know, obviously we were in a band and it was a bit sort of, the scene was very kind of dead in the U.K. in the late 80s. So we went over there and went to Los Angeles and walked up and down Sunset Strip, and we saw all these kind of kids spilling out of the clubs, hanging out on the pavement. And it was amazing because, you know, all the boys looked like girls, all the girls looked like, well, everybody looked like girls. It was a bit difficult to kind of comprehend for an Englishman. But they, you know, very kind of, well, sort of androgynous, but sort of glamorous. And there was all this fantastic music belting out of these clubs. And that was the first time I heard Guns N' Roses and thought, oh, my God, they're good. They're a proper rock and roll band. I mean, I wasn't, looking back, I wasn't a fan of a lot of those kind of, I suppose, hair rock bands like Poison and stuff. But Guns N' Roses were the real deal. And but it was the fact is this whole kind of scene and people hanging out listening to rock music. And that kind of, I think we both found that very energising. And we came back from that trip and that's when Thunder started. So, you know, obviously it was inspirational in some way.
And the song you wrote about it is?
Going to Sin City.
You're right. Pete.
And this is Luke, and we're from the Union, and you're listening to White Line Fever.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the program. And this next guest, we're going to discuss something, even if you're not, you don't know much about the band or you're not into the genre, it's still a fascinating story because this band, Helloween, you know, power metal legends from Germany, about 3 or 4 years ago, they got some former members back in the band and they went on a world tour and they had three singers. And they played big arenas and then COVID happened and all that. But what they've done now is they've recorded an album with three singers and with the current members of the band and some members from their early a part of their careers, some almost 40 years ago. Don't want to make our guest feel old, but welcome to the show for the second time. He doesn't remember last time he was on, but I do. Marcus from Helloween. How are you, Marcus? How are you?
Hello. Nice to talk to you again. I'm fine. I'm really good. But this is 3 or 4 years ago already, you know. Time's flying.
Yeah. So you know, where do I start? I mean, this record, which is always ambitious when you do a self-titled record and you're many years into your career, it speaks of ambition just by doing that. And it was recorded quite some time ago. How long ago was it recorded?
I mean, this was when we finished the tour. That was December 18, was that? Mm-hmm. Wasn't it? We had a couple of months for writing and collecting ideas. And yeah, in the autumn or winter time in the same year, I mean, I have time problems with all that waiting because of Corona. I mean, what was the year we stopped the tour? 18? 20?
Well, I think you were doing the tour in 17 and 18.
18. The tour stopped 18, end of 18, and in the end of 19 we started the recordings into the 20th.
Yeah.
Into 20, and then you know we had some months of collecting ideas, writing songs and stuff like this. So it's kind of a long time ago for me, and I get crazy with times because of the Corona thing, but it took quite a while. We get prepared, collecting ideas and hooking up together, choosing what songs we're going to take for the album, which was, you know, we were not only three singers, we're also five songwriters in the band.
Yes.
And it's never easy to choose what songs you're going to take because you cannot really... You put everything on the record, you know. That's why it's a very long record. We thought we have a lot of cool songs and a lot of cool songwriters. Gives it a big variety of different stuff on the record, having loads of songwriters, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I'm really interested in the interpersonal relationships. Like, I was just thinking then, it's almost like if you had a party, and like, because I've heard, you know, the band compared to a marriage. If you had a party and you invited all your ex-girlfriends along, would they all be exactly the same people when they're around each other? Or would you learn more about them, even if you thought you knew them very well? I suspect you would learn more about them by putting them all in a room together. And you've been there the whole time, Marcus. So was that the case? Are you learning more about your close friends even all these years later?
Are you talking about getting all the people back in?
Into
the Helloween room. It was very interesting because it was loads of years ago. We separated and people change and, you know, time is always also changing people's minds and they get a lot more cooler. And we thought it would just be a cruel idea not even to try getting back together after all those years and trying a new start, you know. Also, the idea was, you know, why firing? Most of the bands are making a reunion, are firing two people and get two old new people back in, which is, in our case, it was like, it would have been a shame firing a very good singer and a very good guitar player to be replaced by another very good singer and another very good guitar player and songwriter. So our idea was to extend the whole thing with two more persons coming into the party, and no, and you know, don't throw anybody out of the room. We thought it's going to be very, very interesting. And as Andy totally agreed with that idea as a singer, we said, well, just give it a try, you know, give it a go. And it was working very, very well. We found out during the tour, because the understanding was great and we felt great hooking up together, hanging around together for a year on the tour. It was just functioning, you know. It was a very, very normal feeling, a very familiar feeling. And that gave us the idea that we could go back into the studio, work together on the creative side, you know.
Yeah, yeah. There's so many examples, isn't there? Like, I'm thinking Kiss Unplugged, and I'm thinking Guns N' Roses, Not in This Lifetime. And anyway, let's have a song there, Marcus. What can we play first?
Oh, at the moment, Angel is one of my favorite songs, but it changes every day.
I've had a dream about forgiveness, but I hear the angels say, the emotions run low. Devil in disguise.
forgiveness.
All right, this is Marcus, the bass beater from Halloween, and you're listening to White Line Fever, and stay tuned. I like it.
Welcome back to the second part of our interview with Jeff Pilson from The End Machine. And for those of you watching, thank you for watching and sorry for the late start. Jeff, I was really interested to hear that you actually have, you can now control George's home studio by remote control.
That's right.
That's a weird thing. Can you explain to us how that works?
Sure. Well, there's a program, it's called Audio Movers for you technical people, where by placing it in George's session, you know, in his, by using, it's a plugin, by using it in his session through an Ethernet cable and through my internet connection, I'm able to get that audio in my studio. Now, is it the same quality as actually being there? No. It's inferior to that. But it's a hell of a, it's a lot better than using Skype, which, you know, is what would be the alternative before that. So basically, we would talk on Skype to communicate, and then I would be hearing his studio in my studio through that program. And you know, again, is it ideal? No. But did it work great? Yes.
Yeah. And as a producer and also a member of the band, I guess in sports, it'd be like being the captain and the coach. You know, you kind of got to be close, but not too close, and you have to suddenly sometimes pull rank. Is that a difficult balance to find?
Not with the musicians that I tend to work with. No, I mean everybody's pretty cool. I mean, you know, it's very rare where I have to say no. We got to do this. It's very very rare. Most of the time, common consensus is found. I find that that's when things are the strongest. You know, is when George and Robert and I all came to an agreement on something, you know, lyrically, chorus-wise, melody-wise, whatever, I knew it was a good idea. So that's my goal, is to try and find common consensus, and always to try and provide a backdrop of the right atmosphere to do that. So, you know, you have to let people do their thing. And we all, you know, we all have good ideas and we all have stupid ideas, you know, that's just how it works. So, you know, I like a fertile breeding ground for ideas. And then if that can be steered into a situation where you have common consensus, I find that that's when the strongest ideas happen.
Your drummer is Steve Brown, which is Mick's son. Is that
Younger brother.
How similar are they?
Frighteningly similar. I mean, I've known Steve since he was 15. Right. I knew he was a good drummer. I knew he was a really good drummer. And, you know, I'd seen, you know, we watched videos and we knew he was a pro and he'd done all that stuff. I knew he could sing, but then when we got in the studio and he actually started playing, I was just shocked at how much it feels like Mick Brown. I mean, I close my eyes and it's Mick Brown, you know, on the glass. It really is. And when he sings, he's got the same kind of timbre in his voice. It's just amazing. So, I mean, we scored. We got the perfect guy in the band. We just did. You know, if Mick Brown's going to retire, we have the most Brown DNA of anybody else in the world.
So if you do another Docket album, I'll talk about that after the next song, but you're just going to sub one person in and one person out? Is that the most likely scenario? And how will the music then be different, you know?
Well, I don't know is the answer to that. I mean, because there's no concrete plans for a Dokken situation, you know, we haven't really talked about it. I haven't spoken with Mick about it. I know he's very happy. I have spoken with him not that long ago, and he's very happy in retirement and has no plans on coming back. But that being said, who knows if Dokken were to happen, maybe he'd be able to do it. I don't know. He's physically capable of it. So it's a question of whether he wanted to, and we'll see.
When you're, we'll have another song in a second, but when you're doing these interviews, I guess some musicians don't think about this and others do. You know, are you thinking about, you know, how do you break that glass ceiling that stands between people who still follow new rock and the fans of Dokken and the fans of Foreigner, you know, who don't listen to new rock? You know, how do you reach you've got one audience over here, which is huge, and you would love to take this thing, new thing, over to them and let them know about it. And how do you do it? How do you, you know?
Idea is through guys like you and through interviews. But, you know, you raise a critical question that we talk about all the time is how can we improve promoting? Because you're right. There's obviously a lot of foreigner fans in the UK. There's there was a good amount of Dokken fans in the UK.
And I'm Australian, so lots in Australia as well.
Oh, you're in Australia?
I'm Australian. No, I'm in London because it's the middle of the night.
That's what I thought.
I'm an Australian, so yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, that's interesting. Sorry, that was my. I've got some guitars being fixed, and that's the guy fixing them. Anyway, what was I going to say?
How do you reach these people?
Yeah. I mean, that's the conundrum. You know, you have to always. I mean, we all know that, you know, the older you get, the less likely you are to buy new records. You know, understandable. You know, you have a life now. You like the music you have, whatever. But I also find that even when people like that hear new music, they tend to go, hey, this is cool, I like it. And so it's really a question of exposure. I mean, you're not going to get every single one of those people to buy your new record, but I have a feeling if there were a lot more exposure, you could get several more. And, you know, that's the goal, and that's what we're trying to do. If anybody has any miracle ideas, please let me know, because I'd love to know. But that's the conundrum.
Let's have another song.
Okay.
What do you want to play, Jeff?
Oh, okay. Let's try the song Plastic Heroes.
Yep, cool.
I love that song, and I love what it says.
Based on hype. So many faces. Which one?
Hey, this is Jeff Pilsen of Foreigner, Dawkins, Dio, you name it, I was in it. Anyways, you're listening to my friend Steve Mascord on White Line Fever.
Okay, welcome back to the program. And this is the second part of our interview with Scott Ginn. Scott, welcome back. You just talked about going to see Led Zeppelin at the Sydney Showground, which is a famous show. It was on their DVD box set released maybe 10 years ago now, maybe even more. And that changed your life. I read that you went and got a guitar, and there was a sale on at the store, and so you actually got musical instruments for the whole family. And then what? It was into covers. It was into performing covers bands.
Yeah, yeah. So I had a friend that we were in a soccer team together, and he picked up a bass, and I had the guitar, and we just started jamming in his bedroom with very loud amps, and his parents were very kind to suffer our torturous sound. I clearly remember the first song that we ever played together was Creedence's Proud Mary. And we were listening to things like, we were listening to Black Sabbath, Master Reality, Grand Funk Railroad albums, that sort of stuff. And of course, Zeppelin and Deep Purple.
Yeah, yeah. And so that became what, you're old enough to go into pubs now. And you're sort of gigging around the place. And what was it like? I mean, I remember a live scene in Sydney that was very different to the way things are now. Can you paint a picture for us of what it was like when you got into the pubs and you started gigging in Sydney?
Well, it's even sort of one step back from that, which was, as sort of 15, 16-year-olds just sort of trying to learn and being most influenced by whatever was around. The scene was really what they were called, like Friday night dances, and there was a whole and often under 18, so focused on, you know, for younger kids, the underage, not drinking age, and so they would generally be held at town halls, civic centres, that sort of thing. So we were, our local haunt was Lane Cove Town Hall, and we would see Finch there, I think early Ted Marlowe Gang, maybe John English, Hush, that sort of thing, yeah. Buffalo. And Buffalo was an influence on us sort of as I got a little bit older.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. And I guess when we were kids watching Countdown, I think it was, on a Sunday night, wasn't it? That we couldn't imagine what it would be like to be on stage kind of singing. We didn't know that they were miming, in that studio audience. And I just watched a video before we did this interview with the Breakers. And you even, I think the song was actually called When I'm on TV. And you were on TV and the camera was actually part of the sort of, they were always very creative with their production, weren't they, on Countdown? And they actually had a camera directly in front of you on stage. What was that like and being on Countdown? I mean, what happens the next day, you know, when did your phone start ringing to your parents? You know, your parents must go crazy that all their friends see you on TV. What was that like?
I guess it was, we'd been watching Countdown for several years. So it was like, yeah, finally we're going to get to do this. I think I was just maybe 21 or 22 at the time, and maybe a little bit older. I can't do the sums, but at any rate, it was the sort of first big, you know, big TV thing for me to do, and it was very exciting. It all goes very, very quickly. You know, 3 minutes of fame, it was just, it was great. And the Countdown machinery, it was a very slick machine how they ran it. Like you said, they got quite creative. That Breakers clip, they sort of did some footage, some pre-footage with Gerald and myself as the guitarist, to set that sort of the TV mode thing up, with the girl watching the TV, and then had the actual live performance for the most part of the clip.
Yeah, yeah. And is it in the middle? Is it in the middle of the day? I mean, you know, do you interact with the audience, the studio audience at all, or?
No, you sort of get a call out, and you're on. From memory, we had a run through first, so you know what's going to be happening. But when it happens, it all happens pretty solid. And it was recorded on a Saturday night, late afternoon, and then went to air on a Sunday night.
Right. The Breakers also appeared in Puberty Blues, which is again, you know, we've already hit three kind of, you know, major touchstones of a lot of people's youth. We've got Led Zeppelin at the Sydney Showground, and we've got Countdown, and now we've got Puberty Blues, the film. What was that like?
That was good fun too. Our involvement was just one night set up at Caring Bar Inn, which was completely appropriate, seeing the whole thing was set around the Cronulla area. And they set the thing up just like a gig, basically. And then we just mimed to the couple of songs that we did. And the footage, the short excerpts were taken from that.
Yeah, yeah. I don't want to sort of get bogged down in just getting you to go over old memories for ages. But you know, you've got some like touring, like that Iron Maiden tour when you were in Boss. That was the Iron Maiden tour when they played quite small venues, wasn't it? I mentioned Shell Harbour Workers earlier, and I think Iron Maiden actually played Shell Harbour Workers, and they're playing significantly bigger places overseas. Was that the tour that you opened for, or was it a later tour?
Yeah, you're spot on. But the city centres were all your conventional. It was Horden Pavilion, Sydney, Newcastle Civic Centre, the Brisbane. Forgotten what the place was there.
Festival Hall.
That's right. And the Melbourne one again. It's going to escape me what it was, but we played Canberra Theatre. I think it was the first night. And the odd one was the Shell Harbour's Workers Club. And it was real, it was sort of thrown, I've still got this program, I'm sure it was sort of just thrown in at the end sort of thing as an extra night sort of in between. And it was really funny kind of arriving at the gig from early for sound check. And the roadies had literally, because the stage just wasn't big enough to accommodate that huge set that they had. There was this whole extra stage that had been built out just to try and get the band on there. So it was good.
Yeah, yeah. So let's have another song, I guess. We're more than 10 minutes in now. What song can we play now?
We might do something from the Rags and Riches Shipwreck album, I think, called That's Life.
Can't you sleep? Got a
Scott Ginn from Rags and Riches and Maz XT, and you're listening to and watching White Line Fever with Steve Mascott.
Welcome back. And it's the second part of our interview with Pete Jupp from FM. I want to thank him for joining us. I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about the hiatus, like 1995 to 2007. Now, to me, in 1995, AOR music was kind of considered soundtrack music. You know, you wouldn't imagine that it had its own scene. Did that kind of play a role in the band breaking up, because there didn't seem to be a market for it anymore with grunge and everything like that?
Well, when the grunge thing came in, I mean, we just became so unfashionable. It was untrue. And it really was. It was like, I just don't think we can... We were kind of going backwards, really. Like I say, we didn't fall out. It was just literally... Oh, I just don't think there's a market for this kind of music at the moment, you know, or whether there will be again. And that's pretty much what it was.
Yeah.
So we took the hiatus, and luckily Kieran Dargan pestered us to do the Firefest. And, I suppose the rest is history kind of thing, you know.
Tell me what it's like to show up there on the night. I guess you've been told stories about it. But to see that this thing, which used to be considered 80s commercial music and like I said, slow motion soundtrack music, I'm not holding you, but that's the way it was considered.
Yeah, yeah. Totally,
that's what it was considered in the mid-90s. Yeah. And then to see it's turned into an underground scene. I mean, what was that like to have this, you know, this revelation, you know?
Well, when we got back to do the Firefest, we couldn't do a warm-up show. We just had to do... We weren't allowed to contractually. We just had to do the gig, which was, you know, nerve-wracking enough. And we had no plans for after the show. It was just, we'll just do the one show. We'll have a good time. We hopefully won't embarrass ourselves too much, kind of thing. And we honestly thought, if 200 people turn up, that's a real result, you know. But we sold out 1,500 people, Nottingham Rock City. And... honestly, this sounds really cliched and stuff, but you could feel the love coming from the audience for the band. I mean, I was sat at the back and I was filling up, kind of thing, just from the emotion.
Yeah.
And we came off stage and it went well, and we were shell-shocked. You know, it was like, bloody hell, we're going to have to do an album now. We'll have to for these people. And that was it. You know, we hadn't thought any way past, you know, just getting to that last of the set, you know. And then it just kind of just snowballed from there.
My wife's in the background here, and we went to one of the subsequent Firefests. It was, after they changed the name, became something else. But I was really interested that AOR has now gone off in different directions. You know what I mean? There's now some stuff that is new. It's new music. It's almost a new... It's an evolving genre, isn't it? It doesn't sound exactly the same as it did in 1987, which people don't understand, I don't think, you know?
No, I mean, you know, AR was always like melodic stuff, wasn't it? You know, and that's what we've always tried to do. You know, when we've written a chorus, it's always got to be a big chorus, lots of melody kind of thing. But I just think, it is evolving, but there's still the melody there. You know, it's... You know, the melody is the king. It's king, isn't it? Kind of always say chorus is king. I don't know. There's a saying, but I can't remember what it is because I'm old and stupid, you know.
Those crazy Scandinavians, the things that they're doing with it are very interesting. Let's have another song there, Pete. What can we play for another song?
Let's go for one of the more obscure ones that we didn't play live. Can You Hear Me Calling?
Can you
Hi, this is Pete Jupp from FM, and you are listening to White Line Fever.
Welcome back to White Line Fever, the third part of our interview with Kelly Nichols. I want to thank him for being with us. Kelly, I just wondered, like, are you someone who, I mean, people have become quite obsessed with the era. The LA Guns, were very prominent and very influential. And as someone who's part of it, are you as wistful and nostalgic as we are? Do you spend time looking at souvenirs of the road and looking at old albums and videos, or do you like just straight ahead? You know, how interested in your legacy are you?
You know, I'm proud of it. I'm not. I don't like to sit there and look at myself all day, or really look at that. I feel like had a lot of it already, so I don't really need to. I'm not super nostalgic about it. I mean, I'll see a picture that I haven't seen or a picture I've never seen on internet or Facebook or something like that, which is kind of cool. So, you know, stuff I haven't seen is interesting. But I don't dwell on the past too much. I'm really looking forward to the future and really wanted to, make a cool record, try to be hip. You know, there's so many songs out today, it's hard to try to be fresh and creative. So that was like the biggest hurdle, but I feel like everything's fresh and it's got a good vibe between the mix of the old band and the new blood, the new guys, Kurt and Scott. So that was a lot of fun. And yeah, it was a great experience writing it and everything. Best recording experience I've ever had because I actually had some say in it this time, and it's cool to just be doing it still.
Yeah. How, when you were doing all that other stuff during that 25 years, how many times, like, did you completely separate yourself from music? Like, was music always part of your life, or did you, I know you've got this, the Montauk Salvage Company, which we should give a plug to. It's a design and photography and really cool stuff like that. Did you completely shut yourself off from music? Did you find yourself getting recognized in the street a lot? You know, what was that period like, and how different is it to your sort of mind's frame now, you know?
Yeah, no, I never I always had a bass and a guitar laying around the house or something, and I've jammed with some friends through the years, you know, just having some fun. But to get into a serious project again, I just wasn't interested. I didn't really like hang out with a lot of other musicians at the time, so I didn't really, I don't know, make connections or stuff like that, you know. And it's just like so much work to get back into it. I just really didn't have the energy or the drive to do it. Almost, I couldn't even go into a club for a long time just because the smell and it just takes me back that I couldn't even want to deal with any of it, you know. But I enjoyed playing. I had a bass around. I would pick it up. I play acoustic. I like to jam a little bit, even, you know. And then I taught some kids that were in the neighborhood, and they won their battle of the bands. So, it's always like right there, you know.
Yeah. But it's the one thing I guess a lot of people remember you for. But when it's you, it's only a small part of your day. You know what I mean? But it resonates with all the people, all the strangers you encounter. It's what resonates. I listened to an interview before where you could have been in garbage, but you didn't show up to the
right.
So yeah, I wonder if for guys, particularly in LA Guns, when you look at Guns N' Roses and you look at their and some other bands, not just LA Guns, and you look at their success and you look at their back catalogue and you look at their soap opera as well, do you look at them and go, well, they were just amazing, they were always going to be huge? Or do you look at them, you know, they're the representative of the scene that survives today, right? They're the biggest representative of the scene. Or do you see luck as part of their story as well, you know, that the timing and all that sort of stuff? I mean, you were around them. you know, used to hang out with Steve and you saw them play clubs. So when you look at them now on TV or on YouTube, do you go, they're brilliant, they deserve everything they got, or do you think, well, they were lucky as well, you know?
Yeah, no, we used to hang out with Duff quite a bit too, and was becoming friends with Steven Adler and stuff. But you know, I think they're amazing and they deserve everything that they got. And you know, they really you know, I'm happy for them, of course.
What about LA Guns? Was there a sliding door? Most people in bands or in most walks of life, they've got a sliding door moment in their mind that if we did that one thing that one time, then we could have been more successful. Do you have some stories like that, you know?
Yeah, I think that's I think it's like baseball. You get three strikes and you're out. I think that we had with Ballad Jane came out, and that was successful. That did really well. That we didn't follow it up with a different single. We had the song Over the Edge, which was in the movie Point Break here, mm-hmm. in America, and that was like a big movie, and we had a song in there, so we, you know, we're like, why don't we, you know, do that song? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there's so many things that happened, like Ballad of Jane even barely made it on the record, you know, so mm-hmm. like record company didn't care, management didn't care, half the band didn't care, and it just ended up like, you know, I got it on there, but it's just so, everything is just so close that,
yeah,
you get, I feel like you get three mistakes like in baseball and you're out. So, you know, not following up Ballad of Jane with a better song, it just didn't make any sense, but you kind of like, we don't have all the power, you know, so you have to go with their judgment too sometimes, and, you know, but it's weird.
Okay. So we'll finish up. We'll get another song off you, but I just wondered if I could ask you one more question. I'm trying to remember what is in 2020, or that's a bad year, let's say 2021. What's success for you and for LA Guns? What does success mean?
You know, I already feel blessed. So, you know, for us, it's just, you know, just grateful to have this project, to be in a band with some very cool people who really get it, that, you know, it is what it is, but we all did, you know, worked pretty hard to get this thing going. We had 7 days to record it. We had 2 days of pre-production, 2 days to mix it, 1 day to master it. So you know, all the work was done in advance as much, and everybody did their homework. And when it came time to record it, everybody knew their parts, and we, you know, we worked on it till the last second. So, you know, we're super proud of it. I've done all the artwork for it. So I'm already feel happy, you know. I mean, we got a record deal without asking or begging for one, so we're, you know, pretty grateful. It just came out of the blue. So you know, that we wouldn't be here probably. We wouldn't be talking about any of this if there wasn't this record done. So we're lucky that we did it before, you know, this year, and we had it in the can. And so let's play "Crawl" by LA Guns.
Showing your age. One chalk cookie and I'm hypnotized. You got it all wrapped up like sugar and spice. Night will come and she will take it all. But everything about you makes me crawl. Yeah. Fingers like the high command. Just a cat in a rock and roll band. Icy cold with the jet black stare. Come on, knees that I just don't care. Now you will come and she will take it all. Everything about
White Line Fever. Going to run land down under. Going to turn around the corner way down yonder. And I'm not even going to try to rhyme anymore. Michael Monroe here for White Line Fever. And Dig, you get a chance, come and check us out live. We're going to rock your socks off and whatever, rock like fuck. That's what I say, okay? Come on down and rock on.